Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about Jean-Paul Belmondo, who tragically just passed. Wonderful French actor with a stellar career and lots of interesting movies, you know, under to his credit. But I wanted to mention from the jump that he enjoyed boxing and playing soccer in his youth and performed as goalkeeper during school years. He entered 30 professional bouts, which left him with a broken nose, a scarred face, and a slope-shouldered walk. And I wanted to point that out because there is something about him that this starts off as battered and bruised. You know, he's very rugged looking. Starting with that, Mike, just the fact that he was a boxer and a brawler, you know, the fact that he could wade into the French movie scene and beat the right man at the right time, because he manages, after a few false starts, to end up in Breathless, A Bout de Souffle, with Jean-Luc Godard in his first movie. And that's really what sets him on the path to fame in 1960.
I really wanted to start also by talking about those rugged good looks, if you will, the boxer's face. It's so appropriate that he actually was a boxer. And the fact that, you know, since we're talking about French film, and we can use some French words, but belle laid, the whole notion of beautiful ugly, in the sense that there's a generation of French actors prior to him, like Jean Gabin, and then later actors like Gérard Depardieu, who were not conventionally handsome, but had a kind of rugged physical appeal. And certainly Belmondo had that. And it really was a very important part of that anti-hero image that he showed in Breathless and then in so many other films in the 60s and 70s in particular. But while we're focusing on his looks, I thought what I would do is, since he passed away so recently, the New York Times obituary actually highlighted the very point Marie and I were just making. So let me just quote from that very briefly in terms of his actual physical appearance. The rugged actor whose disdainful eyes, boxer's nose, sensual lips, and cynical outlook made him the idolized personification of youthful alienation for the French New Wave. So again, Marie, that's so much what we'll be talking about. The fact that when you say he came along at just the right moment, he did. He'd been in some supporting roles in the 50s, background in theater, and then supporting film roles. But Breathless, for all intents and purposes, amounts to a screen debut. I mean, it really was the film that launched him as a star. It also, of course, was the first film for Jean-Luc Godard and, you know, really propelled him to the foreground, the vanguard, if you will, he and François Truffaut and others in the late 1950s. Marie, I'll hand it back to you at this point, because I know you and I both teach French film, but I know French film is so close to your heart. I should really turn it over to you at this point to talk a bit about just what the French New Wave was all about.
Well, I also want to mention that Jean-Paul Belmondo was the son of the renowned French sculptor Paul Belmondo, very well known and appreciated, although I can't say that I'm familiar with his sculpture. That's an important note for later when we get to talking about Itinerary of a Spoiled Child. But in terms of French film, I absolutely love Breathless. I will never forget when I first saw it, just how amazed I was at how daring it was, how it broke all of the standard rules of Hollywood editing, where normally, you know, there was a certain kind of dance that you would do with the camera. You know, you do the, you know, the two shot, you know, you didn't go over to do the over the shoulder shot until you, you know, set everything up and gone through this very structured way of filming something. And then he comes along and, you know, introduces us all to the jump cut, which apparently was, you know, not even intentional. He was just sort of fooling around with it. And in fact, when he had finished making this film, both he and Gene Seberg, who were in it, thought, this is probably a disaster. Nobody's even going to like this, because it just flies in the face of so many things you're expecting. So for example, if a, you know, car is entering the scene, you know, coming from the left and moving to the right, you now think in your mind that the car is on the right. So if the car is going to appear again, that's where it's going to come from. Well, he just, you know, never mind all those conventions, you know, rather than sticking to the idea of hiding the cuts and making it all seamless, he made it jarring. He made you understand the whole time that you were watching a movie and that he was doing these sort of tricky things, constantly made you remind yourself of that, which was a brand new idea for its time.
Yeah, I actually interviewed Jean-Luc Godard in 1980 when he was doing Sauve qui peut la vie, Every Man for Himself. He was at the New York Film Festival that year, and we talked for almost an hour, and he was still breaking the rules, if you will. Everything Marie just mentioned, I mean, he was still going against filmic convention that way. And in Breathless, so much of it, we're going back to 1960 at this point, so much of it was improvised. There was an idea. It's basically, you know, Godard has a famous quote where he says, all you need to make a movie is a man, a woman, and a gun. And in Breathless, he nearly does that. Is Jean-Paul Belmondo playing a petty criminal? I want to describe him just as a petty gangster, but he kills a policeman at the beginning of the film, so he's in serious crime. But for the most part, you'd say it's petty crime. You know, he's going to steal cars, he's going to, you know, take money out of a woman's purse or whatever. I mean, he's doing all kinds of scams. And one of the crucial points is he enjoys his work. In other words, he's not a criminal with a guilty conscience. He likes being a bad guy. And that was part of the anti-hero appeal of Belmondo, that he was, in his own way, charming. Again, the word rugged, but I mean, there was a sense of charm to him, a smooth operator, if you will, as he did that. Now, when Marie and I also were talking about those rugged good looks, Godard, as he was improvising the film, on a technical level, did so many of the things Marie mentioned. For instance, he didn't have enough money for conventional tracks to put on the street for a dolly shot or something. So he would just put the camera in a wheelchair or something and push it around. And so a lot of the dialogue and just a lot of the scenes were thought up on the spot, and that kind of spontaneity, breaking the rules. Because you're right, Marie, a lot of those jump cuts aren't really planned. They're not necessarily designed. It's just turn the camera on, turn it off, try this, try that. And that jumpy quality, the jumpy quality actually perfectly matches the jittery relationship between Belmondo's character and Jean Seberg's character. But while we're still talking about ruggedness within the film, within Breathless, there's a great scene where Belmondo, who's very self-conscious, he wants to be a stylish bad guy, a gangster who always looks in the mirror to check his hat and, you know, the coat and tie and all that. He's walking by a movie theater, and there's a poster for what was Humphrey Bogart's final film, The Harder They Fall, in 1956. And one thing that makes it a great moment is, even though Breathless tends to have a pretty fast pace in some of the scenes, in that scene, Godard deliberately slows things down, and he has a shot of, you know, the poster image of Bogart, and then a close shot of Belmondo's face, and back and forth there. And Belmondo makes a gesture like this across the upper lip, which was, it was a physical tick, if you will, TIC, not CK, but TIC, that certainly, you know, Bogart had his share of ticks, of mannerisms, movements. And this gangster, in many ways, is emulating or wants to emulate a kind of Humphrey Bogart bad guy. And that's also, among other things, a reminder that Godard's generation, Francois Truffaut, Claude Chabrol, others, they were so movie savvy. They would go to the Cinémathèque Française, they'd sit there and watch movies all day long, including a lot of really great American films, but not just great films, because Breathless is actually aspiring to be a B-level picture. It's dedicated to Monogram, one of the Poverty Row studios in Hollywood. It wants to be not just a gangster movie, but a kind of lower grade, bottom half of the bill. And so sometimes the cheapness of, when I say cheapness, I mean really low budget and shot on the run and shot quickly. A lot of that is a kind of deliberate attempt to not make a polished film, but to make a film that is every bit as rough around the edges as its anti-hero. And so, you know, it's really striking then that Godard very overtly, very self-consciously takes us to a movie theater and shows his anti-hero, trying to emulate one of the great Hollywood anti-heroes in so many of his roles.
Now, I wanted to say something else about jump cuts for people who don't understand how groundbreaking it was and how we see it all the time now. The way they would shoot like a person going up to see somebody in an office building, you know, you'd have him walk up to the door, and then you'd have a match cut, you know, with him on the other side of the door, and you'd see the elevator, and then, you know, then you see the elevator, the thing that tells you what floor it's on, then you'd have him come out, and then all of this stuff when you know where he's going. So why not just cut out all that middle stuff and jump right from showing up at the front door to walking into the office? I mean, everybody understands that you went inside and you went up the elevator and all the stuff, but you really didn't have to show it. And it really gives a sense of immediacy and thrusting the plot forward to shoot it like that. However, it's not just as simple as jumping around, because they've tried it with other movies just to see what would happen if you took something like Terminator and just chopped out a frame every 30 seconds. And they said, you know, it's a total mess. You could totally see it. It just looked like you didn't know what you were doing, rather than this kind of artistic thing that Godard came up with. I also wanted to say something about the Humphrey Bogart reference, because what do you think, Mike, in terms of the jolie laid thing, the pretty ugly way of referring to people who are ruggedly handsome, but not conventionally handsome? Isn't that kind of like Humphrey Bogart, who, you know, for a lot of his early career did all of those gangster films and was always kind of the bad guy. And then they made a decision to sell him as a leading man. And so he comes across as good looking, but if you really look at Humphrey Bogart, he's kind of got the same kind of look as Belmondo. And I would say Humphrey Bogart with a little Farley Granger thrown in. What do you think?
Well, that was exactly my point, actually, was that, you know, when the Belmondo character goes to the movie theater and looks at the image of Humphrey Bogart, the way Godard has it cut, it's one face and the other face. It's so implicit that it's explicit, if you will, that he's making a connection between a Hollywood bad guy, or at least anti-hero. Because, you know, when you think about so many of the great Bogart roles, he actually began in a lot of gangster films, a lot of film noir, playing guys who, you know, you think about Maltese Falcon type roles where he's the protagonist, but he's not a goody two-shoes character. And so that was specifically the reason why Jean-Luc Godard wanted to have not just any Hollywood movie star there to look at, but no, a Hollywood movie star who in his own way had many of the qualities that Belmondo's character in the film, and indeed Belmondo in his own career, would be looking to emulate. So yeah, that's the very point right there. And anyone watching the film, even if you don't like know the filmographies and this and that, when you see Bogart's face in close up like that, it reinforces the point that he's not conventionally handsome. He was not physically tall or imposing in terms of leading man appearance. The face has a kind of heavy, haggard look to it. You know, I don't want to like do the full anatomy, if you will, but when you think about Bogart's face and all, and yet, you know, it's always what I call the and yet he is handsome. He is charismatic. He's really appealing. Could you put that in words? You can't always quite fully do that. It's just somehow there's a magnetic or charismatic quality there that just cuts through it. Maybe essentially what we're saying is there's something so distinctive and so strong about that personality that, you know, there is a kind of vibrancy to the character. And certainly the Belmondo character, you know, he's better looking, I would say, than Humphrey Bogart, but still has that boxer's face. And the fact that you can believe this is a bad guy, but in his own way, a charming bad guy. And that's what so much of what the anti-hero is all about. Godard would make use of that in several other films with Belmondo, like Pierre Le Fou, 5 years later. You know, the fact that, you know, we can't excuse or exonerate what these criminal characters do, but they're so smooth and so suave. And anyway, a lot of the establishment figures they go up against are stuffed shirts and, you know, if not vile, at least boring, you know. And one thing I have to say about these anti-heroes, they're not boring. They're really vibrant personalities. So Marie, yes, I agree with you absolutely. That's the very reason that Godard takes time in that sequence at the movie theater to go from one face to the other, cementing that connection between Humphrey Bogart in American cinema and Jean-Paul Belmondo on the rise at this point in French cinema.
I think it's actually sort of amazing that this film did as well as it did, given that there were so many happy accidents, kind of writing the script as he went, giving it to the characters at the last minute so it would seem immediate. And then again, I just want to underscore that, you know, the whole jump cut thing that everybody marvels at was only because the movie was 30 minutes longer than he wanted it to be. So he just chopped it up sort of randomly. And like you said, it really kind of underscores that sort of jittery relationship between the two leads, and also his anxiety over the police finally finding him and bringing him to justice. Now, I said he was like the right man at the right time because he does this movie Breathless in 1960, and it's released around the same time as Francois Truffaut's The 400 Blows from 59 and Alain René Hiroshima Mon Amour, also 1959. So it's like there was this moment where all of these French directors were doing all these interesting landmark movies, and he happened to be in the one that Jean-Luc Godard did.
What's interesting about that phenomenon is it's international. In France, even though we have the release dates, this is 59, this is 60, these films are made within months of each other. And, you know, it's important to remember that. At that time, they were friends. There's a really fascinating documentary film about the friendship between Truffaut and Godard, because Truffaut helped work on Breathless to some extent. They were buddies back then. They had a falling out later on. And this documentary film I'm thinking of, Two in the Wave, is very much about that fractured friendship. And essentially Godard, who remained revolutionary in his thinking, cinematic revolutionary and political too. Godard actually thought that Truffaut later in his career sold out. He thought that Truffaut had gone soft, had gone too commercial. And Godard at that point was getting really edgier, particularly in the late 60s. But in any event, when I say it's an international movement, Marie very correctly identified these attributes of the French New Wave and the kind of tight release schedules of, you know, my film, your film, all coming out at the same time. But these are individual talents. You know, they're part of a movement, but you wouldn't confuse the film of one for the film of another. And yet, The 400 Blows, Truffaut film, was also about, you know, a much younger man, a teenager really, but also a kind of rebel, also somebody who has anti-hero qualities. But the point I wanted to make quickly in terms of international movements, what's going on in Italy, you can find something similar happening with young directors like Pasolini and Bertolucci in Italy at about the same point. You can find something similar in England. Like this semester, I'm teaching a British film course, and we talk about the angry young men in British theater and film at that point, you know, Lindsay Anderson type directors coming out at that very moment. And in the United States, directors like John Cassavetes. There's something, one of my favorite and overused words is zeitgeist. There's something in the air. And you see it in France, which we're talking about, in Italy, in the United Kingdom. And I'll just let it go at that, that it's again, and it dovetails with Marie's earlier observation that Belmondo comes along at just the right point. That's one reason why he becomes such a big star. It's just the right moment to make a movie like this. And Breathless, considering the low budget and the fact that the people making it were essentially unknown at that point, right? The fact that they all become famous because of this one film.
Now, they did do a remake with Richard Gere in the title role, which I don't recommend anybody watch. Now, Belmondo goes on to do other movies with Godard, A Woman is a Woman, and Pierrot le Fou. Anything you want to say about those two movies, Mike?
Well, again, the way in which, as Belmondo got just a few years older, he did become more handsome, I would say. No, he did, really. I mean, in terms of being very well tailored and just really settled into that role. And in Pierrot le Fou, there are marvelous moments where, when I mentioned the identification that Godard made between Humphrey Bogart and Belmondo in Breathless, there's a self-reflexive quality there. What I'm getting at is one attribute of the French New Wave is these movies often will remind you that they are movies, that the people who made these movies were movie mad. They knew their film history. They have cinematic quotations. The dialogue in Breathless is full of toss-away references to other directors and actors and this and that. And some of them aren't there for a particular reason, but just like these are real movie buffs, and that's how they talk, that's how they think. So, and there are times where in the camera work, it calls attention expressively to the fact that this is a movie you're watching. And whether it's a jump cut or a wild pan or whatever, where you're watching a film. Truffaut was doing things like that at the same time. And Pierrot le Fou, which I think is one of Godard's most enjoyable films and one of Belmondo's signature roles, you know, again, he's playing the same kind of a character, if you will. And he and a woman are in the front seat of a convertible, as I recall the scene. And they're talking back and forth. And the camera would be like, in effect, in the back seat as they're talking in the front seat. And suddenly Belmondo, I think he sort of puts his arm across the back of the car seat and turns around. I won't turn around so I'm off camera, but he sort of turns around and looks in the back seat. And the woman's kind of confused by it, the female character. And she says, well, what are you doing? Who are you looking at? Whatever. And he says, well, you know, I'm looking at the audience, or I'm looking at the camera. I mean, he actually says something like that out loud. I think it's like looking at the audience. It's violating, obviously, all those rules of well-behaved filmmaking to acknowledge the presence of a camera and much less of a movie audience. Well, you know, we're talking in the front seat of the car. We've got our back to the audience. That's not polite. I should turn around and face the audience. So Godard loved to have that kind of a joke tossed in a film like that. And so again, that partnership between Godard and Belmondo, it's something, you know, from 1960 and into the 60s. And these are the glory years for the French New Wave, and not coincidentally for Godard, for Belmondo.
Now, it's actually kind of hard to find Belmondo's movies to stream. Hard to find them on Amazon, hard to find, impossible on Netflix. However, if you go to Canopy, K-A-N-O-P-Y.com, they have about a dozen of Belmondo's movies that you can stream for free through your library. So that's how I binged a whole bunch of these movies. And I want to say that two of them that I really enjoyed, first of all, That Man from Rio, which is just this madcap French farce where it's the flimsiest of premises. His girlfriend is kidnapped, and so he's chasing after her to try to save her, which puts him in all of these ridiculous situations. Very funny. But if you watch this, you have to remember that he's doing all of his own stunts, which is actually surprising and amazing because some of them are quite involved. And then the other one I would mention is the Magnifique, where he plays a guy who is a writer, and he keeps writing the people he meets in his actual day-to-day life into his script. So if he has a bad experience with somebody, well, you know, he gives them sort of a villainous take in his book. So both of those movies I highly recommend as high points in terms of the comedic roles that he took on, which I think, by the way, was a smart career move because he could have been kind of pigeonholed into this sort of ponderous art house kind of roles.
Well, you know, I agree with you. That Man from Rio is such an enjoyable, it's a James Bond type thriller. Mm-hmm. The plot is sort of a throwaway, but Belmondo in that film and throughout his early career did all of his own stunt work, as Maurice says. And it's really quite striking that a major star, I don't know how insurance companies would feel about this in terms of film production. And only when he got into his 50s, there was an onset injury somewhere. And so then at that point, he would let other people do some of the stunts. But that's quite striking. Very few stars of that stature would do that. He enjoyed the comic thrillers. Even if there's an ostensible serious subject, forget about that. It's Belmondo looking great in a suit and tie, you know, as an anti-hero. But in terms of those roles, and That Man from Rio was his own personal favorite among all of his films, and he made quite a few films back then. Some others I'd quickly mention would be Mississippi Mermaid from 1969. It's a Truffaut film, so you see him working with Truffaut and Catherine Deneuve in it, so that there's some reasons to watch it. A film of his that doesn't get mentioned at all anymore, and I'm kind of surprised and disappointed it doesn't, is Stavisky from 1974. It was an Alain René picture. Belmondo, again, you know, playing it's a period piece, I think set in the 30s, and you know, very much, you know, gangster-type characters. He's older as an actor at that point by, you know, a decade or more, almost 15 years from when he was in Breathless, but he's still able to play off that kind of raffish charm, that you know, a dangerous man in some ways, but also a man of some stature and a man who's really charismatic. And in terms of difficulty finding some of his films, Marie, this is something to add to the equation. As it got further into the 60s and then certainly into the 70s, Belmondo was, he might still be a bad guy, but not quite as bad. He was sort of like coasting on his charm. The films get softer in various ways. He was making some highly commercial films, many of which did well enough, particularly in France, where he always had a following, but didn't get as much international distribution. And that's one reason why now, even though decades later, some of these films are not easy to find at all, nor should they be films you really search out, frankly. I mean, a lot of these are, some of them were bad or on the scale, somewhere between bad and mediocre. You know, they were just standard commercial thrillers at the time. You watch them now and he's kind of coasting on his charm. He gradually lost, I would say, most of his international audience. His later films oftentimes never even played in our country, did they? I mean, we would read about them. But then if you occasionally saw one or two of these, you could see why. They were sort of standard issue. And then even though he made a lot of films in the 60s and into the 70s, he made very few films in the remaining decades of his career. He didn't need to, you know, financially particularly, and he just seemed to lose that, you know, feeling that he had to be working all the time. I mean, I think at that point he was enjoying life and making the occasional film. But I think honestly, he started to, when I say lose his audience, he never lost his audience in France. I mean, when he passed away, it was a big state funeral occasion, you know, that kind of a recognition. But in this country, when we talk about him, we still tend to talk about him for the reason we should. The French New Wave films with Godard, Truffaut, and so on, the early to mid-60s. The later work, kind of spotty, to be blunt about it. I mean, we would not be celebrating him if we were only looking at films from the 1970s, you know, onward towards the present. What do you think? Because my feeling is it's a career that really creatively peaks early and then kind of tapers off, and definitely has tapered off by the time you get into the late 20th, early 21st century.
Yeah, I think you're right on the money. And I think that just to round out, you know, the who's who of the French New Wave directors that he worked with, Claude Lelouch with Itinerary of a Spoiled Child, which, by the way, you can't even get on DVD. However, you can watch it on YouTube. The entire movie is available to watch. And he won the César, which is the French Oscar, for this role, but refused to take the trophy because the guy that designed the statue had once badmouthed his father sculptor Paul Belmondo. So he refused to pick it up. All right, so we are actually at our last couple of minutes here. And I just want to mention, is Paris Burning? Because it's just such an all-star cast. And it just has so many people in it you don't expect to see. I mean, even Orson Welles has a small... In fact, there's so many famous people in it that if you're watching it for a glimpse of Belmondo or even Robert Stack or Kirk Douglas or all the people you see, there's so many people in it, it takes forever that for them to circle back to your favorite character. But one thing I just wanted to make sure I asked you what you thought, Mike, was how this movie compares to Diplomacy, a movie with the same topic of, are they going to go ahead and destroy Paris on Hitler's orders, or will cooler heads prevail?
It's an interesting question because the films are very similar in terms of that subject matter. But the thing that's so neat for me in Is Paris Burning is just simply there's so many famous faces of that earlier era. It's just fun to watch that way. The viewing experience, in other words, is quite different, even though the subject matter has something in common there. But what carries a film like that is just simply the charm of the cast. And in Belmondo's case, the fact that, you know, not only did he always remain popular in France, but particularly with female viewers, they were just so drawn to him, the same way that women were drawn to Jean Gabin or Gerard Depardieu or Humphrey Bogart, for that matter, right? Casablanca. And there's a wonderful interview with Belmondo where he talks about the fact that women loved him. He was in multiple marriages and affairs and this and that, and the women loved him. So he was asked about that in the interview, and he said, everyone knows that an ugly guy with a good line gets the chicks. And I think that sums it up right there. He knows that the women just, he was a babe magnet. Women went for him. They love that ruggedness. They love the physical appeal. They love the dangerous edge in a way. What, that's what an anti-hero is all about.
And, you know, one of the ladies he was with for a long, long time was Ursula Andress, who said he was the love of her life. I want to mention a quote from him that I really liked about, somebody asked him about his further participation in action films. And he said, I don't want to be a flying grandpa of the French cinema. Which is a great line. Any last thoughts before we close out our show on Belmondo?
Simply that, you know, when you look at French film history, he's on that short list of actors who really resonate. You know, I've been mentioning Jean Gabin and so on, and of the French New Wave era, you know, actors like Jean Moreau and so on, Catherine Deneuve. He's on that short list of actors. I mean, some of them might, technically speaking, be better actors, but who had more screen presence? He's ideal to play that kind of an anti-hero. He looks perfect for that role. And Breathless really just introduced him to the world that way. You see his face, you see Humphrey Bogart's face. They are beautifully ugly, if you will. There's something there that you can't deny. And we still can't deny it. That's why we're celebrating Jean-Paul Belmondo now. Jean-Paul Belmondo is such an enduring presence in French film history.
And that is all the time we have for today's episode. Don't forget to check out our other podcasts at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. Or you can also find it under Dragon Digital Radio on Spotify and Pandora. And we will see you at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.